Good. Let's get started again. Why don't I pray for us? Because we won't understand any of it. We won't benefit from it. We won't be changed by it. We won't be able to teach people if God is not at work. So let's pray that we'd understand and that God would use all we're doing to his glory. Father God, thank you so much for all that you have revealed to us, that you are working to reverse the fall, that you are bringing us to be with Jesus forever, and that you've revealed that to us, that we might be beneficiaries of it. Father, help us now as we work at understanding more clearly what you have said, that we might be more excited by you, more excited by what you're doing, and that would really change us and be of profit to the people in our groups. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Good. Before I get started, Roger just wants to add something to clarify what I said, which I think is really helpful.
Yeah, yes. That question on is this grace or not when God rescues his people? I think the way I'd put it, and Michael was saying this is similar to what he thinks, the way I'd put it is the rescue from Egypt is grace. It is an act of grace from God. But God makes it very clear from the mountain onwards, from Mount Sinai onwards, Mosaic Covenant onwards, that their continued prosperity relies on their obedience as well as his blessing. Does that make sense? So yes, it's grace for him to rescue them. They didn't deserve to be called out of Egypt. But from now on, it's going to be both God's blessing but also their obedience required for continued prosperity.
Thank you. So the conditions are attached to the blessings, not the rescue itself. That's very helpful. Thank you. Good. But let's run through the story from here on. What happens as Israel tries to live under the Mosaic Covenant? Unfortunately, she sins. She sins extremely quickly, and so begins to suffer the curses of the Mosaic Covenant, not its promises. We see that first in the golden calf. So even before God finishes giving the Mosaic Covenant, Israel have started sinning. The golden calf really deserved immediate destruction. That's it. Line under. Game over. But God does not immediately destroy Israel because he is merciful and because he has some crucial lessons he wants to reveal through the Mosaic Covenant. And he cannot do this if Israel is destroyed at this point. But on the other hand, he can't just ignore Israel's sins either. So he institutes the sacrificial system. Where a sacrifice dies instead of Israel. God still punishes Israel, but he does not destroy her for the time being because the sacrifice takes away the ultimate punishment. The sacrifice, the sacrificial system, is an absolutely crucial part of the Mosaic Covenant. But it's worth realizing both what it does achieve and what it doesn't achieve. It does not stop any punishment whatsoever. Even with the sacrifices, Israel gets punished. It does not stop the punishment from ultimately being everything that was threatened in the Mosaic Covenant. So in the end, they're going to end up there. We'll see that before the end of this session. In the end, they're going to get there. And the New Testament tells us in Hebrews 9 and 10 that it really doesn't deal with anything substantial, it's just external. So the sacrificial system is very limited, but it does stop God destroying her right away. So it provides limited help for a limited period. But it does provide help for that limited period. So don't underplay the sacrificial system, but don't overplay it either. So some people would say, oh, well, yes, the Mosaic Covenant does have conditions on getting the blessings, but that's okay because the sacrificial system means that if you are sinning, you can offer a sacrifice and you'll still get the blessings. It doesn't work like that. They do keep offering the sacrifices, as you see throughout the rest of the Old Testament, but they don't get the blessings, they get the curses because it doesn't do the trick, not fully. So the Mosaic Covenant, in other words, is not the way that God will fulfill the promises to Abraham. That means that the promises to Abraham will not get fulfilled this way. But it is not a mistake. This is really, really important. People tend to think, well, if it isn't contributing to the Abrahamic fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises, it must be a mistake somehow, or it's a bad thing. That is absolutely not the case. God knew exactly what he was doing. He's giving it for good. You just need to understand what the way it works. It does not contribute to the Abrahamic promises being fulfilled. It does not contribute to the fall being reversed. But let's look at what it does do. First of all, it's introduced the idea that the cause of the fall must be dealt with before the results of the fall can be reversed. Okay, so it's taught us something really important. We now know that sin needs to be dealt with. Sin is an issue, obedience is an issue, and you cannot get the blessings without obedience. Secondly, it shows us that Israel is incapable of dealing with that cause, that sin, herself. Now, we haven't quite seen that yet, but we will see that over the next few hundred years of Israel's history. She cannot do it. Thirdly, it teaches us that a sacrifice can help turn away God's wrath. It begins to show us how God will eventually solve the problem of sin. And fourthly, it teaches us a lot about God himself. In particular, he's a merciful God. So, the Mosaic Covenant doesn't actually achieve anything in terms of fulfillment of promises or reversal of fall, but it teaches a great deal. Now, if you read the story forward, that's incredibly important, because we know that the promises get fulfilled and the fall gets reversed only through Jesus. So the question we posed ourselves last night is, why do we need the Old Testament at all? Why didn't God send Jesus in Genesis 4 back there? And the answer is because the Old Testament is all there, so we understand Jesus. The Old Testament is there not to achieve things, but to teach things. And the Mosaic Covenant is incredibly important in teaching us lots of things that we need to know. And again, if you read it forward, you don't immediately see just Jesus in the sacrifice. You realize how limited that sacrifice is. So you know you need Jesus. You realize how limited or how non-existent Israel's obedience is. So you realize you need Jesus. But don't just jump to Jesus. Realize it's showing us what isn't working so that we know what we need. Let me pause there for a question break again. Any questions? Good. Let's plow on then. So what happens under the Mosaic Covenant to Israel? Let's run through a bit of history at this point. The first 250 years of the Mosaic Covenant, because of Israel's sin at and immediately after Mount Sinai, God condemns that generation to die in the desert. So for 40 years, they're condemned to wander around the desert until they all die off. But 40 years after the Mosaic Covenant is given, Joshua leads Israel into Canaan, and things initially look good. They enter the land, they conquer the enemy. It looks like the promises are being fulfilled. Unfortunately, Israel keeps sinning, and so she does not inherit the promises. She only occupies some of the land. She has no peace. She has few blessings, and God is hostile. And we see all of that in Judges chapter 2, verses 10 to 15. Roger, can you read that for us, please?
Judges 2:10. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned. And as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress.
Thank you. That's not good, is it? For God's hand to be against them and for them to be in terrible distress, that's bad news. They're gaining the curses, not the blessings. So basically, there they are at Mount Sinai. They sin, so they end up dying in the desert. Joshua comes and it looks good initially. They go back in, and then Joshua dies, and things start getting worse again. And so the big issue, and that continues for 200 years. Okay, so that period of the judges continues for about 200 years, and God is hostile to them, and God is destroying them, and they don't have many blessings, and they don't have much land for 200 years. And the big issue in this period is finding a solution to the problem of sin, because it's sin that means that is happening. So change back to green. And why are they there? Answer, sin is driving that. And so the big question is, how are we going to solve sin? And the one thing that this period in history is teaching us is a good leader can help. A good leader helps Israel obey. So, it was Moses that got them to there. It was Joshua that got them into the land. And all the way through the period of the judges, God sometimes provides them with a good judge and things get better. Then the judge dies and things get worse. Then God provides another good judge and things get better. And then he dies and it gets worse. And it keeps going like this. And I've drawn it downwards because that's the way it works in judges. Each judge achieves less and is less good. And the trend is bad. But things are getting worse and worse. But overall, the picture is a good leader helps. The problem with those leaders, as you can see, is they keep dying and then the wheels come off again. So how can we solve the problem of the fact that you lose the leader when the judge dies? Well, what about a monarchy? That might help, because when the king dies, his heir takes over immediately, and there's always a king. And Judges finishes by implying that a king really will help. Roger, can you read the last verse of Judges, please, chapter 21, verse 25? Yes, 21:25. Is it not on your handout?
Judges 21:25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Thank you. So there's no king. Everyone did what was right. Now, it's not cast iron clear, but it's a hint that maybe a king will help. And indeed, that is right, as we will see in the next couple of books of the Bible. The next big step forward in God's plan is the monarchy. The first king, who was Saul, was not a success. But under the next two kings, David and Solomon, Israel reaches her high point. Under David, Israel fully occupies the land for the first time and comes to enjoy peace with all her neighbors. And under Solomon, she becomes amazingly prosperous. And God's temple, which symbolizes his dwelling with Israel, is built. Roger, can you read 1 Kings 4? And there's a clutch of verses. So verses 20 to 21 first. 1 Kings 4, 20 to 21.
Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life.
Thank you. So amazing prosperity and all the nations around coming are bringing tribute. And can you read verse 25, please?
And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon.
Thank you. So they all lived contentedly, happily, in peace. Dan to Beersheba is basically north to south. So what we'd say is from John O'Groats to Land's End. That's all that's doing. But you need to know some of the geography of the area to be able to understand that. And finally, can you read chapter 8, verses 10 to 11, please?
10 to 11. And when the priest came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord.
Thank you. So Solomon has built a temple, and here God has come and descended on the temple. He is now living in the middle of Israel. So it's an immense period of prosperity. So things were looking pretty grim, and then the monarchy comes, and things look really, really good. They get all the land that was promised. So it really looks like they're getting all that's promised. They get all the land that's promised. They get all the blessings that are promised. They get peace. They get prosperity. They get large numbers of people. They get God dwelling in their midst. It really looks like the promises are being fulfilled. Before I go any further, let me pause there for a question break. Any questions? Good. We'll plow on. Unfortunately, the monarchy doesn't necessarily mean a good leader. So even good leaders aren't perfect. And even the best leaders eventually die and they're replaced by bad leaders. So even David, who's one of the greatest leaders, one of the greatest kings of the Old Testament, even he sins most notoriously, as most of us know, with Bathsheba, who wasn't his wife, and he killed Uriah the Hittite to get her. And because of that sin, Israel was plagued by civil war. God said, because of that sin, war would not depart from within Israel. So there was civil war after that. And Solomon sins even more by marrying non-Israelite women and leads Israel into idolatry. So even the best kings, even the kings under whom so much good is happening, even they sin. And after them come bad kings. However, the king is the way forward, and God makes the third of his great covenants with David, promising that. So that brings us to the Davidic covenant. In the Davidic covenant, God promises David that his descendant will enable Israel to inherit all God promised Abraham. Let me say that again. In the Davidic covenant, God promises David that David will have a descendant or several descendants, and through him or them, Israel will inherit all that God promised Abraham. Roger, can you read 2 Samuel 7, verses 10 to 13, please?
And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I'll raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever.
Thank you. So, you've got there the Davidic covenant now added. And again, in all the areas where of the effects of the fall, God basically promises again that he will bless Israel. So there's a re-promise of all the good things that God will do for Israel. David's descendant will build God a house, verses 12 and 13. Look at that again. Which enables God to dwell with Israel. And we saw that happened in 1 Kings 8. Solomon built the house and God came and dwelt with Israel. And in the Mosaic covenant, God dwelling with Israel was the key to that. It was the key to the relationship with God, as we saw earlier. Israel is also promised a home, a land, and peace, and that she'd be a kingdom, which implies large numbers. And you see that in verses 10 and 13. And very significantly, the descendant will reign forever, ensuring that Israel has all that God has promised permanently. Now that's really important, because what God is promising David is everything promised to Abraham and Moses, and there are no conditions. He doesn't say, and all this will happen if the people obey. It's you will have a descendant, and he will do this. And even if he disobeys, I will take my love away from him. This will all happen. There will be a house. There will be blessings. You will have a land, and it will be forever. And that is particularly important, because at the moment that the Mosaic covenant, that the Davidic covenant is given, things are not that good. It's about halfway up that. But God says, and the history for the last 250 years have been constant sin, constant losing, constant going wrong. So for God to say at this point, I'm now going to make it permanent. Those blessings are not matched by more judgment down there. Is quite a significant step forward. It's not that the conditions have been put in and now it's conditional forever. You will get those blessings and they won't depend on your obedience. And that's very important. The most important thing, the big thing that happens in the Davidic covenant, which is really, really material, is that all this will happen through a king from David's line. And this king will rule over God's people forever. And this is the strand that will lead to Jesus on the throne in the new creation. So it's at this point that that last thing of a king kicks in. The king, we've already seen, is the person who will help Israel obey. So there's something there to do with sin. But the new thing is the king will help Israel obey. So the Abrahamic covenant, in other words, will be fulfilled through the Davidic king. And that's why when you get to the New Testament and Jesus comes, and Jesus is obviously the Davidic king, there are so many references in the New Testament to the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. Does that make sense? Because that king helps people inherit those promises. Those two are inextricably linked. And that's why when Jesus comes, Abraham gets being mentioned again and again and again. Let me pause and take any questions. Any questions on anything up to the Davidic covenant? Yep, Ed.
If the line of kings is so important to pointing towards Jesus and so important in Israel's history, why was it that they didn't start off with kings? Why did they go through the judges?
Again, it's all about revelation. So the whole key to the Old Testament is it's teaching us stuff. It's in the New Testament that things start being achieved. The Old Testament is there to teach. And the point about the judges is, again, they're teaching you the importance of a leader. If you've got a king right away there and things have just gone on, you might not realize just how significant the leader was. But by having these judges who helped when they were there and things go bad when they're not there, by the end of 200 years of it, you've begun to get the point, a leader does help, doesn't it? We need a leader. Which is why Judges ends on that note of, we need a king. So all the way through, you're learning things. From Abraham onwards, you're learning that there is a promise and God will do something. From Moses onwards, you're learning that sin is an issue which needs to be dealt with. From the Davidic covenant onwards, you're learning you need a king from the line of David. Things that you need to learn are being put on the table one at a time. As Israel learns one thing, and she's got it, then the next thing gets added. Any other questions, Rob?
Could you just go over what you said at the end there about the Davidic covenant being linked to the Abrahamic one? You might not be making this point, but was it a point that the Davidic one refers more to the Abrahamic and there's not so much building on the Mosaic covenant?
Yes. That's sort of what I was trying to say. So I haven't made that explicit yet. I haven't said the negative. I haven't said it's not linked to the Mosaic. What I have said is that if you look at the Davidic covenant, the summary is, David, one of your descendants or your descendants will enable Israel to get the Abrahamic promises. All of that is basically the Abrahamic promises. One of your sons will enable them to get it forever. So how are you going to get those promises? Well, you're beginning to see it's not the Mosaic covenant, because under the Mosaic covenant, things keep going wrong because you keep sinning. So how will you get it? Has God forgotten the Abrahamic promise? No, he hasn't. But it's not going to be through the Mosaic route. It's going to be through the Davidic route, through the son of David. Does that make sense?
It does. I was just thinking, could you argue that it's through the Davidic king's obedience, fulfilling the Mosaic covenant, that...
You could. So at this point, it's not clear how the Davidic king will get you there. There's an element of the Davidic king who will help people obey, but that's just not clear.
So it's not the Mosaic covenants off the...
No, it's not. It's definitely not off the radar. The Mosaic covenant is still there, at least for the time being. Again, read it forward, and things don't become clear right away. Tensions build, and you're not quite sure how they'll resolve, and you need to read forward to find out. At this point, Israel is still under the Mosaic Covenant, and it still looks like they will be judged because of their sin. But we know a king will help. How? Don't know. Maybe it's by helping them obey. That seems to be the implication. In the end, it will turn out not to be, of course, but we don't know that yet. Any other questions? So again, you can always shortcut the tension by jumping forward to the New Testament and say, no, it's not so much that the king helps them obey, it's the king obeys instead of them. But you lose so much of the tension and the what's going to happen, how is it going to work, which gives it the excitement and means when you do discover how it works, you think, yes, now I've got it, as opposed to, yeah, okay, I knew that all the time, which just loses so much of the force and so much of the impact.
But with the language of being a son, is that new to the Davidic? So the idea of I will be to him a father, no. He will be to me a son, is that?
Not entirely. So in Exodus 4, Israel is described as God's son. But that idea of sonship becomes bigger. But when you reach Luke 4, I think it is, you discover that the sonship thing runs all the way through. So Adam is a son of God. Israel is a son of God. The Davidic son is a son of God. But it's only the Davidic son who's the real son of God, the obedient one. But that's Luke 4. Don't jump there yet. I think we do. I think, is that still one of the passages you still have?
Yeah.
You still do it. So that's still one of the exciting things you have to find out. Any other questions? Good. We will plow on. So, Israel is now under the Davidic covenant and the Mosaic covenant. What happens? Well, the Davidic covenant is still a promise for the future. It's still in blue. And Israel's experience now is still very much governed by the kings she actually has who are sinful. So David sins and Solomon sins. And their successors sin very badly. And the books of 1 and 2 Kings go through all Israel's kings, and we keep looking to see if this latest king is the one who is promised, and we are continually disappointed. Instead, because of their sin, God punishes Israel. Now, God's punishment, because he's a merciful and a patient God, it doesn't happen gradually as people sin. It happens in lumps. He's patient, he's patient, he's patient, he's patient. And then he says, right, I've been patient long enough. Judgment is about to fall. And really, the fate of Israel after this period is governed by three great disasters. It's a period of 350 years, and we have three great disasters. So things are looking pretty good. And then because of Solomon's sin, the kingdom splits. So let's put some things on. So you get monarchy there. But because of Solomon's sin, you get the split of the kingdom. And we're now close enough to us in time that we can begin to put dates that we understand. So obviously we're having to read backwards from Jesus. It's quite difficult to date some of those. But the split we can date, it's 922 BC. And for 200 years, you have a split kingdom, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, because of Solomon's sin. And after that, in 722, you get the Assyrian, I'll call it exile. And that's in 722 BC. And that's where the northern kingdom, which is the bulk of the people and the bulk of the land, gets conquered by the Assyrians, and the people are taken away and dispersed, and they're lost forever. And the northern kingdom goes and is never again referred to, or comes back. And the third great disaster, 150 years later, is the Babylonian. And that happens in two phases. In 597 and 587. So many of you will know this, we mentioned it several times from the pulpit, but the Babylonian exile, the southern kingdom, which survived the Assyrian crisis thanks to God's rescuing help, 150 years later, because of her ongoing sin, God sends the Babylonians to come and conquer her. And first of all, in 597, the Babylonians conquer, but don't destroy. They put a puppet king in place. And because the puppet king then continues to sin, they come back again in 587, and this time they finish off the job and they destroy the southern kingdom of Judah. And at that point, they are back, they're down at the bottom there. They've got all that was threatened to Moses. Just to make the point, they really have got all that was threatened to Moses. So let's have a look at that to see that. Roger, can you read 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 8 to 11, please?
Yep. 2 Kings 25, verse 8. In the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, that was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every great house he burned down. And all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls round Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who deserted to the king of Babylon, together with the rest of the multitude, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried into exile. But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen.
Thank you. So look at what's happened at that point. God's temple is destroyed. The place where God came to dwell with the nation of Israel, that's now gone, burnt to the ground. Israel has lost her land. Both the north and the south, they've lost the land. It all belongs to somebody else. There is no blessing. They are slaves of other people. They're in exile in other places. They've got no prosperity. They've got no peace. Many of the people have been killed. And Israel has ceased to be a kingdom. There's no king. They're now a province of somebody else's empire. It is not good. God's promises in the covenants are not fulfilled at any point up to there. It looked almost like they were getting there then. It was within a whisker of getting it. And then the wheels came off and it all went horribly, horribly wrong. And by the way, people might say, well, surely they did get it there. Why do I say they're only within a whisk of getting it? The answer is because at that point, one of the things that was promised is that they will have it forever. Clearly, if they've lost it all, they haven't got it forever. So actually, it looked like they had it, but because it wasn't forever, they didn't, and they've lost it all. And that is the lowest point of Israel's history in the Old Testament. So if under David and Solomon was the high point, after the Babylonian exile, it's the low point, and things are as bad as they could be. But, and this is very important, God's plan is still on track. Things look really bad. Israel's sin means she has not inherited God's promised blessings. But God's promises to Abraham and David are unconditional, so he will fulfill them. If you just had Moses, you could say, well, God said, if you disobey, all these terrible things will happen. You did disobey. All these terrible things have happened. So, again, we could draw several of these, but it's sin that's making this happen. Okay, this is all sin that's driving this fate of Israel. Sin is this thing that's meaning all these things are happening. It means that under the Mosaic Covenant, it all goes wrong. They get judged. But the Mosaic Covenant isn't the only covenant God has made. He's made the Abrahamic. He's made the Davidic, where he's promised on his own integrity, absolutely, that he will give Abraham the land forever, that there will be a king who will rule and give Israel peace and prosperity forever. And therefore, even though things look as bad as they could be, we don't give up. We now know there is hope. So we're waiting to see how God is going to solve it. And because it's not the end of the story, because there's still hope, God continues to speak. And he speaks at this point through the prophets. And what he says through the prophets is he reveals there will be another covenant This is the fourth and the final one of the great covenants he makes. Now, the exile, the period which we're talking about now, is a huge part of the Old Testament. Okay, we're going to cover it quite quickly, in 10 minutes or so. It actually accounts for about half the Old Testament. It's amazing how much airtime is given to what's happening around the exile because it's so important. But some of it is quite complicated. So first, take through the overview. We don't spend too long there. But when we do the third weekend of the year, the eschatology weekend, we'll revisit some of it and we'll begin to understand it a little bit more. That's part of the way it all works. But let's have a look at this new covenant that God makes. And what I'd like you to do now is, in pairs, again for 5 minutes, look at the following passages, please. All from Ezekiel. Have a look at Ezekiel chapter 34, verses 25 to 30, and Ezekiel 37, verses 24 to 28. Can you read that? 24 to 28. Again, don't cheat. It's on the next table, so you could cheat very easily, but don't. Have a look at those two passages, and your task again is to see, in the new covenant that God is promising there, how does what he's promised fit in with our five themes of relationship with God, land, curse, death, and sin, and king, six themes. So that's your task, and you've got 5 minutes in pairs. Good. Are we more or less there? Good. Let's come together again. I hope that you saw quite clearly how much everything that was promised to Abraham and David is re-promised again here. So Ezekiel is speaking right in the middle of exile. Ezekiel goes to exile halfway through that, well, as part of that first wave, and prophesies all through that period there. And when things are as bad as they possibly could be, he is talking about how God will fulfill everything that he's promised to Abraham and David. In fact, some of the promises God gives at this point go very much further than anything God has said prior to this point. So let me run through some of those, even though you've seen it, just because it's so important. We don't want to lose it. First of all, Ezekiel says they will be God's people. He will be their God, just as Abraham was promised. And he will dwell with them, just as he was promised to Moses, the good part, and David. Roger, can you read chapter 37, verse 27, please?
My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Thank you. There we are. The Abrahamic, they will be my God. They will be my people. I'll be their God. And the Mosaic, the Davidic bit, I will dwell with them. They're promised their own land, just as Abram and David were promised. Can you read chapter 37:25, please?
They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever, and David, my servant, shall be their prince forever.
Thank you. However, at around this time, God is actually saying how much better the land will be. Keep a finger in Ezekiel, because we'll keep coming back to it. But Roger, can you read Isaiah 65, verses 17 to 25? Isaiah is just before Ezekiel, both historically and in terms of where it is in the Bible.
Isaiah 65, 17 to 25. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat.
For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labour in vain, nor bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Thank you. Now that's an incredible step forward. We're told now that it's not just they're going to get the land, they're actually going to get new heavens and a new earth in which there's no weeping, in which nothing goes wrong. You're not going to be in that state of you do something and somebody else gets the reward or somebody else gets the credit, where things go wrong. No weeping, no suffering. Even the animals will be at peace. The wolf and the lamb will lie down together. This is a huge step forward in God's promise. But that's not the end of it. There are also promised blessings in it. Can we go back to Ezekiel and have chapter 34:26, please?
34:26. I will make them and the places all round my hill a blessing, and I will send down the showers in their season. They shall be showers of blessing.
Thank you. So the word blessing explicitly used in the Isaiah passage helps us understand a little bit of what that blessing will look like. They're promised large numbers, as Abraham was. Chapter 37:26, please.
I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will set them in their land and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forevermore.
Thank you. So you see, down there, lots of people have been killed in the various exiles that have happened. But God's saying, I'll give you lots more people. But again, this is one of those areas where he goes much further at this point than he has previously. So again, keep a finger in Ezekiel and go to Isaiah 25. Verses 7 to 8.
Isaiah 25, verse 7. And the Lord will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken.
Thank you. So it's not just that they'll have many people. Death now will be dealt with. So do you remember we said that back there with Abraham, that we began to get some sort of reversal of all that went wrong in the fall, but it was very limited. Canaan is not Eden. Many descendants is not a full solution to death. Now, however, we get a promise of a new heavens and a new earth, which is at least like Eden, and death really is dealt with. So what the prophets do is they're promising everything, so that's the prophets. And I draw it as an angled line because that goes on for 250-odd years, whereas all of those happen over a very short period of time. So that's prophets. And now we have a promise of a full reversal of all that went wrong at the fall. For the first time in the Bible. All this will happen. All this can happen. All these promises are given to Israel and are now unconditional because as part of what the prophets are saying, God now commits himself to dealing with the problem of sin. And this is obviously really important. So God will cleanse them from their sin. God will give them new hearts and his spirit. And they will keep the law perfectly. Can you read Ezekiel 36, please? You didn't look this one up. Ezekiel 36, 25 to 27.
Ezekiel 36, 25. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean from all your uncleannesses. And from all your idols I will cleanse you. And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules.
Thank you. So why is it they can have all that and it's now unconditional? Because God will put his spirit in their heart to help them obey perfectly. Sin is no longer a problem. God will solve that green problem of sin. But that is such an important idea that God makes the point in several different ways. So in Ezekiel, the way he makes it is, I will put my spirit in you and cause you to walk in my ways. In Isaiah 53, which we all know well, but Roger, can you read 53, 5-6? He puts it a different way.
But he, the servant, was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.
Thank you. So that's picking up the sacrifice idea which came in from the Mosaic Covenant, but saying now we'll have a sacrifice that actually works because it'll be God's obedient servant as opposed to a helpless little animal. And finally, there will be an everlasting Davidic king. And that king will be key to inheriting the promises, just as we knew from the Davidic covenant. So back to Ezekiel. We've read it a couple of times, but just because this is the best place to pick that up. Roger, can you read 37:25 again?
37:25. They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever. And David, my servant, shall be their prince forever.
Thank you. So they will get this Davidic king, who will be their king forever. So that's a restatement of the Davidic covenant. But again, this is one of those areas where God goes much further at this time than he's gone previously. And you see that again back in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, which we all know from Christmas, but this is how it fits in. Isaiah 9, verse 6.
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
Thank you. Now just look at that. What you've been told there by the prophet is God is going to send you somebody to sit on the throne of David. We know that, Davidic covenant. Yep, Ezekiel, we're expecting this guy to come to be the king forever. Good. Who will be called Everlasting Father, who's God himself. So why is it that this king will now succeed, whereas all those kings failed? Even good ones like David failed. Even other good kings, which we got on the route, like Hezekiah and Josiah, failed. Because they weren't good enough. But now you'll get a king who is good enough. But the only way he's going to be good enough is by being God himself. Let me just try to summarize all of that. Then I'll take a question. Take some questions. At the exile, God comes and speaks again to say it's not the end of the story. The unconditional promises remain. He's committed to them. And he restates all that he promised in those unconditional promises to Abraham and David. And he adds three major, major big things which take the whole story a huge step forward. First big thing he adds is all the results of the fall will be fully reversed. It's the first time in the Bible story we have a full reversal of the fall promised. It's the first time we can be sure that God's plan is actually to reverse the fall completely. So up to this point, the whole thing could just be, and things won't be as bad as they could be. I'll give you a bit of a land. Yeah, you've lost all the promises. You've lost Eden. You've lost life. But I haven't washed my hands of you completely. Here's the consolation prize. Up to this point, that could be all that God is promising. Now we know he's promising much more. He's promising full reversal and more of all that went wrong. So that's the first huge step forward. Second huge step forward, all that can actually happen because God will deal with the cause of the fall as well as the results. That's what's been wrong ever since the Mosaic Covenant was inaugurated. Sin meant that they were being judged, they were getting those curses. Now, however, God says, I will deal with a problem of sin by making you sinless, new heart, spirit in you, by having a sacrifice which is perfect and actually works, which means that any consequences of sin are taken away, and by giving you a king who will actually help you in this. So the problem of sin actually now dealt with by God. So if the Mosaic covenant was, let's split the task, I will deal with the consequences, you deal with the cause by obeying. At this point, God says, right, well, we've seen that's not going to work, haven't we? I'll do both sides of it. Does that make sense? Again, you can see how reading the story forward helps you see so much more. By reading it forward, God has built up over a 500, 600-year period how if Israel is left the job of trying to obey, they cannot succeed. They keep failing. And by the time you reach the exile, you should be absolutely screaming up the wall, saying, come on, guys, haven't you learned your lesson? Stop sinning. But they still can't. And so when God steps in and says, I'll do it, you think, whew, at last. But if you don't read it forward, you don't get that force of, isn't it wonderful that God will now come and do it? And the third great thing that is revealed at the time of the prophets is that this king from David's line will be God himself. So why is it that the Lamb in the new creation sits on the throne? God alone will rule. God alone can rule Israel. Israel shouldn't obey anyone other than God. So how can they obey their king? Why should the king have rights over the nation? Answer, because this king will be God himself. Those three things, the cause of the fall fully dealt with, the results of the fall fully dealt with, and the king being God himself, are incredibly important. Now, to us, it appears quite as sudden. We spent 2 hours this morning working up to there, and not much seemed to happen. And then suddenly, we have three major, major steps forward. But the answer is, as I said, if you read the Bible story forward properly, not even the way we're doing in the overview, but actually read the whole thing, you'll find that you're in this period of the exile, it would seem interminably. Half the Old Testament is written at this point. You are there for page after page after page as God fleshes this out and unpacks it. And we'll see a bit more of it and how it all works at the third weekend of the year, the eschatology weekend. So that's a motivation to come and to get your groups to come along as well to that. Let me pause and take any questions. Any questions?
They're revealed by different prophets at different times to different people because people die, but most of it is revealed to the southern kingdom of Judah. A couple of the prophets do speak to the northern kingdom of Israel, Amos and Hosea in particular, but actually not much of that great revelation is given to them. Yeah, you realize it's all to the nation of Judah. Israel has basically lost it there, and it's off the picture, effectively. I mean, again, there are layers and layers of complication. And God, Paul in the New Testament talks about some of the stuff to the northern kingdom and says that's actually the Gentiles. But that's sort of layer 13, don't deal with it absolutely at this point. But when you know the overview and you read Romans, you think, that's how it's fitting in. But that's sort of a little twiddle on the top of the basic plot. Yeah.
So just discussion we had in our three was the word covenant. I mean, why do we call them promises? Because if the Mosaic one is one of the covenant, but Abrahamic and Davidic are both promises, and new is a promise because there's only one side.
Yeah. The answer is because the Bible calls it a covenant. So the covenant functions differently, and we haven't looked at it, but I think you do look at it in one of the studies, is the way it works in Genesis 15. That is... Yes, so there is a covenant made in Genesis 15 between Abraham and between God and Abraham, but God basically does the whole thing himself. He basically says there is a covenant, there is a deal, and I will take the full obligation on myself. And so the Bible does call it a covenant. Yeah. Roger.
An illustration, if you like, God does marry Abraham, but only God makes vows. Whereas when God marries Israel, marries the nation at Mount Sinai, he says, this is my part, now here's your part.
Yeah.
If you're obedient, I'll bless. If you're disobedient, I'll curse. Yeah. But they're both covenant relationships. They're both contractual and committed faithful relationships, like a marriage, but just different promises they're making.
Using God, the Bible uses the same word, two things which are, I guess, so different in their nature.
Well, they're different in that one respect, in that this one has two parties to it and the others only have one. But they're very similar in that all three of them are talking about God going to do something and he's binding himself rigorously to doing it on certain conditions. But the conditions there and there and there, he fulfills. Was the condition there, they fulfill. So there are similarities and differences. Dan. Good question. That covenant hasn't been made yet. God promises he will make it. He says, I will make a covenant, but it's future. So if you live in the time of the prophets, you live under those three covenants and their intention. So you ought to feel that tension. You ought to be thinking, if you're a thinking person at this point, this begins to answer the question I think you asked earlier. You're caught in the, I've read my Abraham and I've read my David and I'm told God's going to do it unconditionally. Yippee. Now this morning in my quiet time, I read my Moses and I suddenly realized that's not going to happen. And now I'm stuffed. Which way is it going to go? Is God going to do it? Or do I have to obey? And I know I can't. And if you live at the time of the prophets, you should be sort of having this tension working in your mind the whole time. And the resolution is not yet. The resolution will come. But at this point, there is that tension running.
Does anyone express that tension? Is there a person in that time who ever says, oh, I don't understand how this works?
The Psalms do.
Can you think of one offhand? So the psalmist, David certainly says, the blood of bulls and goats you do not want. A broken, contrite spirit, O Lord, you will not despise. So he knows that something is... So. Lots of people know that the mosaic doesn't quite work. They know that they have to offer the bulls and goats, but they know they don't work. But I don't think they, I can't think immediately of somewhere where it expresses that tension explicitly, unless you can think of one.
I can't remember which number psalm it is. The one that says, you made all these promises to David, and yet now our experience as a nation is that we're failing and going into exile. 89. So you get psalmists saying, I thought we had the promises to David and I thought they were unconditional and were definitely going to happen. And yet, as the exile happens, people are saying, well, hang on, this isn't what's supposed to happen. Yeah. But then there are other psalms which say, we're getting what we deserve, because right back with Moses, you said that if we disobeyed you, this will happen. So I think across the book of Psalms, you do it. Yeah. Which our second weekend is going
to
look at.
Is James coming to do your second weekend?
Yes.
Brilliant. Ask him. I think he still thinks this. He's, James Healy Hutchinson, who did his PhD on the Psalms, reckons that Psalm 89 is the most important psalm in the Psalter. It's the turning point of the Psalter because you get that tension. Of the first half is you have made these promises to David and they're unconditional. And the second half of Psalm 89 is, but now the wheels have come off, we've lost our king, our king's been taken off, and we've lost the land and everything. And the psalm stops. And you don't have a resolution. You've got the unconditional promise to David, and you've got the reality of disaster, and there's no resolution in the psalm. Read on. Thank you. Rob.
Sorry, can I just check? I heard you say something.
Oh dear, that probably means I didn't.
No, I just, it might be that I heard you right. Were you saying that the cause and effect are met in two different ways? So the effect is met by the Davidic king, and the cause is met by God bringing about obedience in us? Or is it a little bit more complicated?
No,
than that?
That wasn't what I intended to say.
Right.
The effect, the result, God is going to do. The cause dealing with sin is such a big deal that God talks about it in several different ways.
at least three different ways. So first of all, he says, I will make you obey by putting my spirit in you. Secondly, he says, I'll give you a sacrifice that actually works. And thirdly, he says, I'll give you a king that actually genuinely does help. So all the way through there, we saw a king really did help because it did help them obey. Now, it's not explicit this king will, how the king will help, but they'll have the king which previously have helped them obey, has helped them obey. Now, exactly how it works, that last king one isn't that clear yet, but it's part of the dealing with the cause.
How does the sacrifice help deal with the cause?
Because the way the sacrifice worked is when you sin, a sacrifice means you don't suffer the punishment. So even the sacrifice comes in that all the sin you've ever committed and any sins you commit, the sacrifice now deals with. So you don't have, if you like, you may still sin, but there are no consequences of that sin any longer. So it doesn't matter. So the new heart, law written on your heart means you won't sin. The sacrifice means even if you do sin, it doesn't matter.
Sorry, I might be being a bit slow. Does that mean your sacrifice is dealing with the consequences or...
Can we postpone that?
No, it doesn't, because when I say consequences, I mean getting things like land rather than anything else.
Is the line at the end of the prophets higher than creation and equal with new creation? Is that intentional?
No, thank you. That's the last thing I want to say before we stop. So that's the trouble with having the board so wide. That goes now completely flat to that. And that is a really, really striking thing. That actually, in terms of all sorts of things, there's still a lot to happen in the story. But in terms of what God has revealed about what he's going to do in the end, about putting right to the fore, the reversal of the consequences, the land, the blessing, the peace, no death, there is nothing material added after the exile. And that, when I first saw it, really blew me away. I thought, you mean the whole New Testament doesn't add anything? Actually, it doesn't. If you look at Revelation 21 and 22, everything promised there is promised by that point. Now, that's not... That, actually, if you then look hard enough, you find a couple of tiny little tweaks which add about nothing of any consequence. Sorry, you were going to go on, Andy?
And is it meant to be higher than the original creation?
Yes.
Or
for all sorts of reasons, which we dealt with earlier. Yeah, you can't sin. Jesus is on the throne. There are all sorts of reasons why that is higher than the original place. But yes, we didn't say explicitly that's because you can't sin. But that's so we could lose Eden. We can't lose that. That's very helpful. Thank you. Anything else? Let's wrap up there. Take a quick loo break, coffee break, and be back. Can we say 20 past? Let's go for 20 past if we can.
Purely, yeah.